Columbia Pictures presents an association with Marv Films, a Matthew Vaughn production. The back doors of a 1960s Ford Transit van emerge from a black screen.
When I was born, the world was a far simpler place. It was all just cops and robbers.
The back doors of the van are blown open. A robber runs to the van while another, in a stocking mask, brandishes a sawn-off shotgun.
Marty, get down! Get down there! Hey, shoot! Stay down!
But it wasn't for me.
A bearded hippie drags on a joint.
Then came the summer of love. Hashish and LSD arrived on the scene.
The hippie is surrounded by women in a faux Eastern-style room. A woman in a bikini walks across the room. This gives way to a screw walking into a prison refectory.
There were villains locked away for 12 years for robbing a bank of 10 grand, doing time with drippy hippies who were doing 12 months for smuggling 2 million quid's worth of puff. I mean, work it out, mate. We're in the wrong fucking game. Drugs changed everything.
In a shop, shelves of FCUK designer label drugs line the shelves. Amongst them, FCUK reality cocaine, intensify your life, and FCUK ecstasy.
Always remember that one day all this drug monkey business will be legal. They won't leave it to people like me. Not when they finally figure out how much money there is to be made. Not millions. Fucking billions. Recreational Drugs PLC. Giving people what they want. Good times today, stupor tomorrow.
As the narrator walks through the shop, the slickly packaged drugs turn into more recognizable products in a chemist's shop. The narrator selects a jar of something and heads to the till.
But this is now. So until prohibition ends, make hay while the sun shines.
The narrator, who's about 40 and has neat fair hair, pays and goes. He walks down a street.
I'm not a gangster. I'm a businessman whose commodity happens to be cocaine. I mean, 10 years ago, a bit of Charlie was for pop stars or a celebrity's birthday bash. It was demonized by Daily Mail readers getting drunk in naff wine bars.
He goes into a house.
Now they're my biggest clients.
Inside, a man smokes a cigarette.
This is Clarkey. Double first at Cambridge in industrial chemistry. Well, he's got to pay off his student loan somehow.
The narrator joins Clarkey, who wears a surgeon's face mask and gloves.
Today, I only deal in kilos. And depending on which tariff you use, that'll cost you either 28 grand or 15 years in prison. Which is more time than a rapist. C'est la vie. It is vital that we work to a few golden rules. Always work in a small team. Keep a very low profile. Only deal with people who come recommended. I mean, it's like selling anything. Washing machines, handmade shoes, blowjobs. As long as you don't take the piss, people will always come back for more. I mean, that's not to say that we don't weave that special kind of magic that makes 2 kilos into three, but never be too greedy.
The narrator and Clarkey look up from cutting the kilos of coke as they hear the police siren.
Know and respect your enemy. It is only very, very stupid people who think the law is stupid.
A patrol car drives down the street outside. In Amsterdam.
And a void like the fucking plague. Loud, attention-seeking, wannabe gangsters in it for the glory, to be a face, to be a name.
Hello, Slavon? Yeah, it's the Duke. Everything's sweet. How could we meet?
They don't mean to fuck up.
What time? Where?
They just do.
All night.
The Duke, a sort of Del Boy gone bad, walks down the street with his squeeze and two accomplices. In London, the narrator and Clarkey weigh some coke.
Now, forgive me for stating the obvious, but stay away from the end user. They are guaranteed to bring you trouble. As do guns. I hate guns. And violence. But, as some Roman general once said, if you seek peace, plan for war. Morty and his assistant Terry, they watch my back. Morty learned to be cautious the hard way. He did 10 years inside. He's my bridge to the criminal world. And he ensures that the traffic is one way.
The Duke's lost.
There's Amsterdam, and there's Oofdorf.
Yeah, I'm not fucking clue. None of them speak English.
Come on, get in the car. Get in the car. I'm sure it's that way.
Yeah, I'll move up.
I bet you it's that way.
No!
We've already been that way.
Yeah, well, we're going to go that way again.
Yeah, kiss the mat.
They drive off past a commercial greenhouse.
Now don't start a Perry, for fuck's sake, I've been having Perry Kings.
The fucking bollock egg at you all day.
You can't be that difficult. How many fucking greenhouses can there be?
The narrator hands out wads of cash.
40.
Terence?
Thanks, mate.
Arky?
Very, very important. Pay your supplier prompt. In our case, that's Mr. Jimmy Price. He's the top of the pyramid. Pay him. In full, on time, without fail, no short counts, you get no second chances. Jimmy calls the shots.
Where the fuck is Gene?
I don't know, mate. Ask me while I'm sport.
What time does your watch tell?
Probably the same as yours.
And it's never late.
Would you two shut the fuck up?
Morty points at Clarkie.
Patience.
Gene here is Jimmy's right-hand man. Been with him since way back. All the drugs and cash go through Gene. Jimmy trusts him with his life.
The narrator hands Gene a slip of paper.
Mm-hmm.
He studies it and nods approvingly.
Oh, by the way, Jimmy would like to see you tomorrow for a spot of lunch.
Wait a minute. Is there a problem?
Why does everybody assume there's a problem just because Jimmy wants to have a word, huh? Maybe he's grateful. He fucking should be. See, it's Stoke Park at 1.
The Duke drives through a vast greenhouse full of tulips.
This is just so beautiful.
Right, we need to get in and out of here sharpish, holding the tide anchor away.
They arrive at a steel roller door and a man indicates for them to stop. The roller door rises, revealing a man in a suit behind it. He beckons to the Duke. In London, the narrator steps out of a door marked private.
Everyone likes to walk through a door marked private. Therefore, have a good reason to be affluent. I own a share in a very successful letting agency. Gives me an honest income. Looks good on the self-assessment.
He gets into a black cab.
Whereas years ago, scallywags were trying desperately hard to get money out of banks, now your problem is how to get your ill-gotten gains into the bank. Well, that's a job for Mr. Singh. He does my laundry, and in a week's time, it will be ready for collection in the form of a nice, clean check for a round million.
He leaves Mr. Singh's office.
The business is on the up and up. But I've always said, have a plan and stick to it. Quit while you're ahead. So barring any fuck-ups, I'm leaving it all behind.
The Duke.
No, we've got the parcel. Yeah, better than expected, actually. But it's just that things have gone a little bit slightly turbo this end.
It's dark as the Duke pulls up out of Jessie.
Come on, boys, lively.
If we miss this tide, we're not going anywhere till daylight.
Oh, you ain't being paid to moan, mate. You're being paid to get my cargo home.
Come, babe, you all right?
Yeah,
they board the boat.
Life is so fucking good, I can taste it in my spit. I'll treat tomorrow's lunch like the Last Supper. Feign interest in the old boy's nostalgic tales. And then leave quietly forever.
The narrator goes through a door marked layer cake. The next morning, he emerges in a fresh shirt and jacket and gets into an Audi estate car with Morty, who's waiting outside. They drive off. Daniel Craig, Colin Meaney, Kenneth Cranham, George Harris, Jenny Foreman, Marcel Ures, and Michael Gambon. The Audi speeds up a road through a golf course leading to a palatial country club. Tom Hardy, Thomas Hassan, Ben Whishaw, Bern Gorman, Sally Hawkins, Sienna Miller, Dexter Fletcher, Steve John Shepherd. The Audi pulls up outside the country club and the narrator and Morty head inside. Casting by Gina Jay, Leo Davis, costume designer Stephanie Colley, music supervision by Liz Gallagher, music by Lisa Gerrard and Ilana Shkel. Morty admires the imposing architecture of the club as they walk through it.
This is pure glass.
Production designer Kay Quinn. An urban, nearly-suited middle-aged man approaches the men.
Please, follow me, gentlemen. Mr. Price is in the overview.
They follow the man to a busy restaurant. Director of photography, Ben Davis. Editor, John Harris. Screenplay by J.J. Connolly, based on his novel, Layer Cake. Men go into a private room where Jimmy Price and Gene are waiting.
Your guest, Mr. Price.
Thanks, Angela. Welcome.
Oh, sit around. How are you getting on with that packy accountant I put you away? You still doing the business?
Raj is doing a very good job. He's a
good, good. Paying a bit of straight goes tax, eh?
Well, we all have to do our bit, don't we, Mr. Price?
Say hello from me next time you see him. You hungry? The grub here will make your bollocks tingle. Let's eat.
Executive producer Stephen Marks. The Duke and the henchman, Gazza, sit at a table in a boatyard.
Right. All we got to do now is test the old snap, crackle and pop factor on these little babies.
Well, don't ask me. I ain't fucking touching them.
You are a miserable bastard. You really are.
Another rather gormless-looking henchman wanders in. The Duke glances at Gazza and smiles.
Brian.
What?
Sit down, mate. Got a little treat for you.
Brian sits down next to Gazza.
Help yourself.
Brian picks up a pill off the table and tries it. Produced by Adam Bowling, David Reed, Matthew Vaughan. Directed by Matthew Vaughan. In the country club, Angelo lights a large cigar for Jimmy Price, who blows out a plume of smoke.
A little privacy, please, Angelo.
Angelo leaves the oval room, shutting the doors behind him. Jimmy stares across the table at the narrator. Jimmy's about 60 and has a hard, lived-in face.
What do you want, son?
Excuse me?
In life, what are you after? A shot at the title? A seat by the band?
The narrator leans towards Jimmy.
Well, I don't know, Mr. Price. That's a very expansive question.
Right, expansive. Good answer. You know, years ago, some people would have thought you were a homosexual using a word like expensive. You're not a homosexual, are you?
No.
Not behind me to rent?
No.
No, I didn't think you were. No harm in it, I suppose. Times change. You know why people like you can't leave this business?
Morty glances slightly apprehensively at the narrator. Gene notices.
Because you make too much money for people like me. Anyway, I'll get to the point. I need a favour. I need someone who's a bit cute, a bit of a smooth operator, not a two-a-penny loudmouth, too many grasses around.
Well, it'd be a pleasure, Mr. Price.
Jimmy. You can call me Jimmy. Now, this favour, it's not for me, if the truth be told. It's for a good friend of mine. Like a blood brother, we were at school together. Now he's a right wheeler dealer, flinging up skyscrapers. His wife's a proper blue blood. I'll give you a clue. Eddie Temple. Does that name mean anything to you?
I know who you mean.
Now, Eddie's got a daughter, Charlie, bless her. The light of his life. He worships the ground she walks on. She's a proper beauty, Charlie. Ought to give her a correct moniker. Charlie Spencer Temple. But she ain't behaving like a lady. She's hooked on the white powder and loves a wrong'un. And this is where you come in, right? You're going to find her.
Find her?
She's gone missing.
Well, you should get a private detective.
Oh, right. Well, some nosy ex-policeman still on the payroll at Scotland Yard, you mean?
Yeah, but...
She's done a runner from a drug rehabilitation unit in the West Country.
Right, rehab.
She got loved up in there with some fucking low-life crackhead called Kinky. Well, I reckon they've legged it back to London.
I wouldn't even know where to begin.
Every now and then, we're asked to do something above and beyond the call of duty. It's called sacrifice, son. Ask Jean. Ask Morty.
I'll do my best.
You do your best and find her. Keep Mr. McGuire posted.
Jimmy gets up and opens the door. Angelo comes back in as Jimmy turns to the narrator.
I've also got a little business, more in your usual line. Gene will fill you in on the details.
I hope everything was to your satisfaction, Mr. Price.
Fucking excellent, Angelo.
Thank you.
Jimmy signs off the bill and turns to the narrator.
Details, details. Things to do, things to get done. Don't bother me with details, just tell me when they're done. Who said that, son?
Winston Churchill?
Close. No, I said it. James Lionel Price.
Good boy.
Jimmy heads out and Gene turns to the narrator and Morty.
I'll see you two at the yard tomorrow, say 4 o'clock. I'll tell you about that bit of business. I've set up a meet for 5 with the Duke.
The mention of the Duke makes the narrator wince. At the boatyard, the boatman Paul comes in and finds the Duke and Gazza with a bombed out Brian.
What's with him? He's just had one of these. He's a super ease, mate. We're gonna make millions!
Hey, I don't care.
This is my boatyard, man. No, I want those pills and that fucking idiot out of here now. I can't afford to get nicked.
Paul, calm down, mate. What's the matter with you? I've got Jean coming down with a buyer. You'll be in your whack. Here, chill. Have a pill.
The narrator and Naughty are in a car with Jean.
Jean, why aren't we doing business with the Duke?
Yeah. Why are we dealing with this Joker? He's a fucking maniac, a relic, a throwback. Belongs to the Dark Ages, Jean.
Will you just shut the fuck up? We're dealing with the Duke because he has 1 million ecstasy pills of very high levels of MDMA, okay?
1 million?
Gene, that is a lot of pills. What's the tax on that?
Jimmy wants 50% netto.
Love a bit of cloak and dagger, this lad, don't he?
Oh, yeah, driving a bright yellow Range Rover. Very subtle.
You two calm down. You feel better once you got your money out.
Huh? Yeah, with how much money he's spending in Parker to buy this club's Gene.
Paul opens the boatyard door to them.
Come on.
Jean turns to the narrator.
Oh, don't go getting Duke on it. Jimmy doesn't want him fucked about, okay?
Who? Me?
Don't you fucking talk to me like I'm some kind of mug. Fucking talk to me like
Duke,
that.
Duke, don't take this personally. It's business. Now, you want to know how much these pills are worth?
Yes! Fucking please!
Right, now, just because you pay a fiver a pop down the local cattle market, don't, for fuck's sake, start thinking these pills are worth millions. They're not. We've got to find someone to buy these pills, and then they've got to split them up into parcels of, say, I don't know, 100,000. They've got to find these people. It's hard work.
Oh, you give a fucking aspirin a headache, pal!
Then you've got currency fluctuations, you've got police activity, you've got adverse publicity. I mean, you tell me, who has got the readies lying around to pay for a million each?
This is fucking bullshit! Sasha, shut the fuck up!
Sasha retreats. The Duke and the narrator sit across a table from each other.
Duke, we all want a good deal out of this.
Mate, look. That parcel of pills has got to be worth 5 million easy.
£5 each, yeah?
You are fucking joking. It doesn't work like that.
Don't keep fucking saying that to me.
The Duke's on his feet.
I've got some samples. I'll stay in touch with Jean, okay?
The narrator walks out. Jean follows.
You wouldn't be so fucking flash if you didn't have him behind you, would you, eh?
Yeah. Well, he fucking has, ain't he?
Jean raises his eyebrows. Outside by the car...
Where the fuck did these monkeys get a million E's?
Don't worry about that. Can you place them?
Well, we know someone up north who can buy them. Morty, set up a meeting with Trevor and Shanks in Liverpool.
Morty nods. They climb into the car. Two guys are surrounded by girls at a club.
Well, what's really bothering me, of course, is what colour to get the Aston.
Well, as you're driving it yourself, probably green is a good idea.
Green?
Yeah.
Well, it's a trifle dull, I thought. What do you think, girls?
Black. Yeah, black.
You can't have black. Black's the colour for a hearse or a taxi.
No, don't be so conservative, Hugo. I think black's a splendid idea. Oh, hello. Look who it is. Sit down. Do join us.
Can we have a word?
Our dreary broker has arrived. Hugo, follow me.
Don't go anywhere. We're coming back. Drink some more champagne.
Yeah, sure.
Especially you. I like it when you're drunk.
The guys go with a narrator to an office.
Yeah, you're the master of that.
What are you up to tomorrow?
Oh, we're doing the number on these young American birds.
Yeah. Who am I today?
You, my son, are in fact the Earl of Oxford.
The Earl of Oxford?
Fucking hell.
So what's this bit of business then, eh?
Well, it's something a bit strange. Can you find somebody for me really quickly?
Well, how quickly?
£20,000 quickly.
He tosses an envelope.
Okay, got our attention.
The so-called Hugo opens it and hauls out a photograph of the missing Charlotte. The Earl of Oxford grabs it.
Very nice. I suppose this is the boyfriend? It's a bit unusual for you, isn't it? What's going on?
Doesn't matter. Can you do it?
The two con men look at each other.
Yeah.
Should be a doddle.
All the same, aren't they? Fucking junkies and crackheads. Chuck them a few quid. I'll cough. Is there anything else?
No.
All right, well, we must get back to work, old boy.
In the club, the narrator bumps into a punter.
Oi. All right, mate. I'm the Duke's nephew. Remember me, Sydney?
Sydney. Yes. Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm just off. You have a nice night.
How you doing? What are you doing here? I hear you're doing a bit of business with my uncle, the Duke.
Oh, great. Why don't you tell the whole fucking room?
A pretty blonde turns from the bar. The narrator stares. Sydney pulls her forward.
This is Tammy.
Who's your mate, Sydney?
He's a good mate of my uncle's, the Duke. He was just going.
Yeah, well, stick around and have a drink before you do, yeah?
She smiles broadly at him. His eyes inspect her.
Yeah. All right.
I've got VIP down here. Nice little booth.
He follows Sydney and Tammy, who keeps looking back at him.
Charisma! He's fucking got it. I mean, I know he's my uncle and all that, but you can't deny it, know what I mean? Boy, if you want anything, right, just tell me, because I've got him right straightened out in here. If you want anyone in the back,
the narrator is sitting in the booth, his arm over the back of a leather banquette. Sydney's right in his face, but his attention is on the dance floor, where Tammy, smoking a cigarette, is dancing. Tammy blows out smoke as she looks across the room to the pair in the booth. She raises her arms above her head, eyes on him.
Lie?
What?
I said, do you want a lie?
No, mate. Knock yourself out.
Sydney fidgets and looks up and sees Tammy dancing.
Lovely, isn't she? Is she a darling?
Sydney, baby, I could do with a live man.
She leans over Sydney, places a note in the narrator's hand and mouths, ring me too. He pockets the note.
Sydney, it's been great. I'll see you, man. Thanks for the champagne.
The narrator shakes hands with Sydney and walks away, leaving the slim bearded guy alone in the booth, rocking to the music. A cleaner pushes a trolley along the first floor outside landing of a two-story motel. In a downstairs room, a guy waits for her to pass before continuing his sweep for electronic bugs.
You let me know when you're happy, Mr. Lucky.
The warm down your way.
We'll get busy, Trevor.
Everyone wants a slice as well.
Same wherever you go. Greedy people.
Yeah, it's all clear, Shanks.
You lot would know all about that, wouldn't you?
What the fuck's that, Shanks?
Well, not you lot, but...
He gestures with one hand behind his head.
The team down your end, like you don't know.
No offence, Shanks, but what the fuck are you talking about?
You really do surprise me, do you know that?
Do you know something we don't?
Don't! Be given it. They're big fucking... innocent, pal. Because I am not a fucking prick.
I never said you were, Shanks.
Cool it, Shanks. You really don't know? Explain.
I was over in Amsterdam last weekend, right? The whole place is alight with a rumour about how this hooligan outfit from down your end, run by this joker, he's called a Duke.
Get that? Go and find them fucking pills.
Right, come on.
A flashback.
Now, he scanned his outfit like a proper, nutty Serbian militia.
No, Mr. Duke, you're the first person ever to be foolish enough to try and steal from me.
Shut up.
But you're not the first adversary to hold a gun to my head.
Shut up, or I'll be the last.
Gazza rips open a bag of pills.
Fuck me.
And he got lucky because he just knocked up a massive batch.
Fucking jackpot.
Oh, this fucking
me!
The fuck is here?
The Duke forces the Serbian to his knees.
You, what's in?
Sasha holds an Uzi machine pistol on the Serbs. The Duke races off to find Gazza. Slab of the Serb to Sasha.
That looks very heavy for you, darling.
Fuck off.
The Duke runs the pills through his fingers, then turns to Gazza. Slavo.
Why don't you put it down?
Why don't you fucking shut up?
Look at you, little girl playing games with guns.
I ain't no fucking little girl. Why don't you shut up?
The Duke sniffs a pill.
You are shaking.
Fuck off. Why don't you shut up?
Are you just going to show up?
I said fuck off, yeah?
Just put it down.
Why don't you listen to me? Why don't you
sit down?
Sit down. Fuck off.
Sit down.
A shutter opens and a greenhouse worker carrying plants is shot by Sasha. The Duke rushes back. Gazza holds two Uzis on the surface.
Calm down.
The Duke strides up to Slavo.
This will not be the end of this, Mr. Duke. Believe me.
Gazza? Go and load them pills. But he got unlucky. Because this lot are wanted for fucking war crimes, mass murder, ethnic cleansing. They're lunatics. They're wanted by the United fucking Nations. Think about that.
Let's get this clear. Duke has absolutely sweet fuck all to do with us, understand? Everyone in Amsterdam believes that he has. He banded your name, suppose.
What? The word on the Straz is they've unleashed their top boy. His name is...
Dragon.
Slavo's on the phone. He tells Dragon they fucked us. Find who's responsible and bring me his head. His head.
That is party piece, friend. He's lobbing people's heads off. Then fetching them back to his boss.
It's all about honor and respect with these headbanger nationalist outfits.
That's right. They can't ever get about that anybody has took liberties with them.
But we had absolutely nothing to do with the acquiring of said merchandise.
Okay, we accept that, okay. But, with you lot up here punting this shipment, you tell me, how does it look?
The narrator's and Morty's associate, Clarky.
Bad.
You do know, don't you, that, we're only talking pennies an article. Stolen goods.
You won't want them, then.
As he rises, Trevor and Shank step forward.
Sit down, lad. Let's not be too hasty. Me and him need to have a little think.
Well, don't think too long, because someone's going to make a killing on these pills.
They already have. That's the problem, get out.
In Paul's boatyard, a domestic iron steams. In Morty's car...
That prick Duke's made us look a bunch of fucking amateurs.
I told you he was trouble, didn't I? But he ain't going to drag me down with him. Try Gene again. What a fucking show.
He's not answering, Morty.
Okay. Try Jimmy at home.
You sure?
Will you fucking ring him?
Teddy and Clarky are in the back of the car.
Where are we going, Morty?
Back to that boatyard. Somebody's about to get a fucking slap.
Yes, Morty. Bad fucking time.
Teddy slaps Morty's arm and grins. The car crosses the cobbles leading to the boatyard and stops. The four guys climb out and the narrator leads the way into the boatyard where the iron grows hotter. They walk down a stairway. In the workshop, they march through in single file. The narrator is at a doorway. He looks in and sees the steaming iron, turns to Morty, then strides off. Morty looks inside the room. Paul's body lies on a table, the iron burning a hole in his chest.
What a way to go. An iron burning a hole in your chest until your heart boils. Paulie would have told him anything then, wouldn't he?
The narrator's upstairs in the letting agency with Morty, Teddy and Clarky.
You see, that's what happens when you do business with looms.
Clarky.
Morty pours himself a drink.
Have a sniff about. Make some phone calls, but really quietly. Find out where the Duke's hold up.
He wags a lecturing finger.
We're going to need an insurance policy.
What's the fucking idea of phoning me at home and leaving messages, you little prick?
Jimmy, it was an emergency.
Don't fucking call me Jimmy, you little toe rag. And what's the idea of telling Duke those pills ain't worth shit? Oh, you don't know the problems you've caused. And don't be leaving it to that pair of ponces, Cody and Tiptoes, to be finding that bitch Charlie.
Mr. Price.
I fucking told you to do it! You listening?
Find a buyer for those pills.
The person charged with moving those pills met with a very nasty
end. I don't give a fuck!
The narrator, who's sitting up in bed, hangs up. Later, he and Morty pull up in the Audi outside a high-rise estate. They get out of the car and walk towards a large, drab-looking building. Inside, Cody is waiting by the door to one of the flats. The narrator and Morty round a corner past an abandoned shopping trolley and find him.
That was quick.
Right, I got to tell you, the gaff is rotten in there.
Kinky's still here, isn't he?
Didn't Tiptoes tell you on the phone?
Tell me what? Have you let him go?
No, I haven't. He's in here.
Cody goes into the flat and the narrator and Morty follow. Cody opens the door to a room where a semi-naked body lies on a soiled old mattress.
Kinky.
Cody looks at the narrator.
I still want to be paid.
The narrator walks on into the flat. Morty stands in the doorway and looks in at the stiff. A tourniquet is still in place around Kinky's left arm.
So, if I've assessed the situation correctly, which I think I have, you three gearheads are going to be clucking very soon. If it actually looks like you're clucking already, you're going to be climbing the fucking walls any minute, aren't you? But I'm prepared to do you a favour. You see, we can do this one of two ways. We can do it the nice way, which I think you'll prefer. Because the other way is that my friend here takes you one by one, puts your head through the fucking window. Right, so, was Charlie here with Kinky?
Yes, he was here for a couple of days. Kinky turned up with $5,000.
$5,000? Who's giving Kinky $5,000?
We don't know. Them two kept arguing. She was saying, do you think it's that easy taking that $5,000, messing them about, but she was still carrying the rocks and smoking the gear.
Where is she now?
Brighton. She kept begging Kinky to go with her. You're not to get away.
The other night, yeah, I hear this noise. I'm like looking up there, and it's dark. But I see this geezer, like, and he's creeping around all in black. It's like something out of a fucking kung fu film, you know?
Pay no attention to him. He's a fucking nut.
You, son, shut the fuck up!
And you? You fucking tell him now. What geezer?
I don't know. I goofed out myself. And the next morning, she's gone and fucking Kinky's dead.
What are you trying to tell me? That somebody's topped Kinky?
Kinky fucking overdosed. He always was a greedy fucker.
Fucking go over, man. I saw it with my very own fucking eyes, man.
You
I
smoked
saw it.
Too much of that. Man, you smoked him in like fucking rocks. Fuck up,
as the Slackheads fight amongst themselves, Cody lobs them some cash.
Morty.
Oh, this is dodgy, mate. That kid's talking about murder.
He's talking shit. Now just get down to Brighton and finish the job.
I've got to talk to Tiptoes. It all smells a bit fishy.
I'll double your money.
All right, and I want 10G for finding Kinky.
That wasn't a fucking deal.
The narrator heads off.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Cody wanders back into the flat. The narrator makes a call from a phone box.
Hello. Ambulance, please. 185 Kirby House, King's Cross. There's a dead boy. And the door's open. My name.
He glances through the call box window.
185 Kirby House.
Later, the narrator and Morty sit facing each other at a table in a nearly deserted Greasy Spoon cafe. Morty has his clean-shaven black head cocked to one side as he stares at the narrator.
I'm not happy.
The narrator shifts uncomfortably in his seat as Morty leans forward across the table.
The shit is out of control. You sort it out or I'll sort you out.
Morty, Kinky OD, that's all.
Morty sits back.
Charlie woke up, found him cold, freaked out, fucked off down to Brighton. Cody's gonna find her.
Morty fixes the narrator with an unconvinced stare. The narrator picks up their cups.
I'm freshening these teas up in the cold.
He goes to the counter and a shabby, unshaven individual in a grubby Mac comes in.
Morty! Is that you?
The man sits down opposite Morty.
Where you been hiding now, eh? Good hell. What's going down this neck of the woods for, eh?
Hello, Freddy.
Grungy Freddy grins amicably at Morty, who looks like he's just found something unpleasant on his shoe. Freddy tucks into a fool English and dribbles egg down his chin. Morty and the narrator watch as he messily masticates large mouthfuls of chips, black pudding, bacon and beans.
So,
Freddy lights a fag.
Mr. Mortimer, eh? Here, Morty, can spare us a few quid, could you? For old time's sake and all that. You look well flushed, bruv.
Reluctantly, Morty takes a wad of cash from his pocket.
Fuck me, he's loaded.
Freddy looks up at him hopefully.
Yeah. Could make it five, could you? Mate.
Let's make it 10.
Yeah.
10's a nice round number.
He throws the money at Freddy.
Swear with you!
Morty smashes the tomato sauce bottle into Freddy's face, then whacks his head into the tabletop as he launches a frenzied assault. He repeatedly kicks and punches Freddy as he lies on the ground. You can Sasha having a confrontation with someone by some earth-moving equipment. Back in the cafe.
What's happening, Bitterwell? Yeah! Fucking yeah!
He stamps on Freddy. Things seem to be going badly for the Duke and Sasha, too.
Oh, you need a red light.
Morty carries on kicking and punching. The Duke and Sasha look scared.
Morty! Enough! He's had enough! I'll see when he's fucking had enough! What the fuck is this?
Morty walks over to the counter and picks up a catering-sized teapot and carries it back over to Freddy.
Well, let's forget about all that. Let's have a cup of tea, Mr. Harris.
Morty pours the entire teapot full of scalding liquid over Freddy. The lid falls off the teapot and the teabags come out. One of them lies steaming on Freddy's right ear as he lies unconscious on his back. It seems things have been going even worse for the Duke, who also lies on his back somewhere. His eyes stare sightlessly, and a bloody wound flowers on his chest. Gloved hands drag him away. Morty and the narrator outside the cafe.
What the fuck?
Sorry about that. I won't be around for a while.
Morty and the narrator hurriedly head off in opposite directions away from the Regency Cafe. That night, Gene answers the intercom phone to his apartment.
Hey. Hey, come on up. I'll leave the door off.
He hangs up and leaves the front door open and goes into the bedroom and packs some clothes into a black bin bag. The narrator comes in and shuts the door behind him. He walks through into the living room and picks up a framed photograph of Gene and Morty holding up a large fish. Gene comes into the living room and he and the narrator swig from bottles of beer.
How's your day been so far?
Very fucking funny.
Gene sits down on the sofa.
Have you eaten? I'll have a chinky sent up.
No, I'm fine, thank you. Gene, who the fuck is Freddy?
Freddy used to run with me, Morty and Jimmy in this real kamikaze firm. In those days, we were headed up by this guy called Crazy Larry.
Yeah. Got shot, didn't he? Bit of a lunatic.
Well, that's another statement. They were a spun-out bunch, always doing loads of drugs.
Hey!
Not worried about keeping a low profile.
I love you.
Turn over anyone who couldn't go screaming to the law. No fucking problem, boys will be boys. Until one of them, Kilburn Jerry, shoots himself stone fucking dead. Now, this is a bit of a dilemma. Because this desperate posse can't call the law or an ambulance. Morty, out of some mad fucking sense of loyalty, actually volunteered to dispose of the body. No head. But things went a bit wrong. The guy Larry told to help him was Freddie Hurst. The total imbecile had fallen asleep at some traffic lights in a drunken, drug-induced stupor. Morty was still shut up in the back of the van with the headless body of Kilburn Jerry.
A copper finds him.
In those days, being black was even worse than being Irish. They threw the book at Morty. Freddie got 3 years for aiding and abetting.
So Morty did 10 years because Freddie Hurst fell asleep?
But he kept his mouth shut. Did his board. Earned a lot of respect for that. And all because some kid was being ridden against his will by a bullying psychotic lunatic.
Who?
But you! You fuck!
Larry!
Crazy Larry was gay.
Was never gay. Oh, Larry used to say,
fucking females is for puffs.
So who shot Crazy Larry, one of his boyfriends?
Probably. Larry made enemies very easy. Took liberties with too many straight lads.
Gene pours himself a whiskey.
Not for me.
Listen, son. Let me explain something to you. Freddie's in intensive care with a bit of a brain hemorrhage. You were there at the scene. That's called joint venture. Now, Freddie dies, you're either in the dock with Morty or you're in the witness box, putting him away. Think about that.
Gene sips his drink. The narrator points to the whiskey bottle.
You know, I will have one of those.
A whiskey. In an industrial lockup, Gazza, Brian and Nobby watch a porn film as Sydney comes in.
Oh, yeah. All right, fellas.
Where's Joe?
I don't know.
What do you mean, you don't know?
I don't know. I thought he was here.
Well, go and fucking find him.
Sydney gets up.
He's probably having a night out while us fucking mugs babysit these.
The E's.
Gene, what the fuck am I going to do about these, sir?
Gene clears away the remains of a Chinese takeaway.
Come here. I have something for you.
Gene leads the narrator to a gun cupboard. It contains a large selection of pistols, including a Luger and a Thompson .45 machine gun.
You're gonna need one of these.
Fuck me, Gene. I fucking hope not. Are you trying to scare the shit out of me? I mean, I fucking hate guns. Although that one is really pretty, isn't it? Is that Second World War?
Hey! Point it upwards, sir.
The narrator poses with a Luger.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
He aims the weapon down a corridor.
Here, let me see if it's loaded.
Gene takes the Luger into the living room. As the narrator pours out a couple of whiskies, Gene strips the pistol down. He removes the magazine and puts it on the table, then removes the pistol grip and trigger unit, finally stripping the return spring at action. The narrator looks impressed.
You look like you could do that blindfolded.
I can. And I do. I find it very relaxing. Good for meditation. See, meditation is concentrating the front of the mind with a mundane task, so the rest of the mind can find peace.
They sip their drinks.
And you find peace with guns?
On occasion, it has been known. Listen, I know it's not your thing, but if you ever have to kill somebody, never, ever tell a living soul.
Gene stares steadily at the narrator, who after a moment raises his glass. They both drink. Later, the narrator lies asleep in bed. As he fumbles for the phone, he pulls the duvet aside, revealing a silenced pistol on his pillow. He answers the phone.
Who is this?
My name is Dragon.
The narrator pulls the duvet aside.
How do you get this number?
Boatman Paul gave me your number in the end. Well, I believe you have some property that belongs to my employer. And you're the person I should talk to about the return of this cargo. Stolen by your associate, the Duke.
Dragon. The Duke is nothing to do with me.
The Duke came to Amsterdam, used your name, said he worked for you.
The narrator picks the gun up from his pillow.
Are you listening?
Dragon.
He sits up in bed, the pistol in one hand, phone in the other.
I've got an idea. Why don't you come round for breakfast? I'll squeeze some orange juice and grind some coffee and we can talk about this like adults. How does that sound?
Sounds very hospitable.
Do you know where I live?
No.
Well, fuck off then.
The narrator hangs up and tosses the phone aside. In the bathroom, he poses in front of the mirror with his gun, then examines it. Gazza's in a call box making a call to Gene, who's fishing.
Jim's gone missing. It's a fucking nightmare in the picture everywhere. This was meant to be piss easy, no fucking sweat.
Calm down, Gavin. I'm sure Duke's just fine.
Yeah, well, you've got 48 hours to find the buyer. I'm sending him back, okay?
Listen, don't do anything stupid, Gazza.
I'm worth the grief. We've gone underground, mate, off the radar. Nothing personal, but I don't trust you or any fucker.
Gazza hangs up and joins Gobby outside. As they wander off, Gazza gobs in the street. In an ultra-modern kitchen, Gene is busy gutting a sea bass as the narrator comes in. He leans against the worktop.
Listen, I just had a phone call from Gazza, being a crybaby, threatening to offload those pills in 48 hours. Now, between you and that gobshite Duke, he's promised Jimmy a bumper payday. So you better get busy, hadn't you?
Hey, look, I said to Jimmy I'd try off.
He put yous together, you and Duke. That's his job, huh? If you two can't make music, he's gonna want his wife killed either way.
Gene chops the head off the bass, then puts the fish in a freezer. He wipes his hands on a cloth and turns to the narrator.
That's business.
He wanders out of the kitchen. Later, the narrator is back at his letting agency with Teddy and Clarky.
Well, I hope you put this Dragon straight.
Yeah, I told him to fuck off.
What? Please tell me you're fucking joking.
Well, I'm beginning to regret it now.
He stares thoughtfully into the distance.
We've got to find the Duke. Find these fucking pills. We can't rely on these fucking monkeys to call Gene whenever it suits them.
I've looked everywhere. There's no sign. They've all gone completely offside.
You're telling me you can't find any of his firm?
Maybe this Dragon geezer's already found a Duke and, you know, done the business.
Yeah, well, there is someone I can call. You two, keep looking.
Wait, you're gonna leave it to us?
This Dragon geezer is phoning me. I am the target. And if we don't find the Duke, this, everything, all over.
The narrator marches off.
Hello?
Hello. It's me, Sydney's mate.
Oh, hi, yeah. What took you so long to call?
I've been busy. You sound sleepy. You're just woken up.
Tammy's in her flat.
So when am I going to see you?
What are you doing now?
Nothing. No, I was just lying in bed.
Wondering what to do.
She's sitting with her mud pack on her face, painting her toenails.
You still in bed?
Yeah.
He's in his letting agency office. He sits down and glances to see no one's listening.
You lying there naked?
No, I've got a little t-shirt on. But that's all. Here, wait, listen to this.
She rubs the phone and the arm of her chair.
What's that?
I was just rubbing the phone against my fanny. Did you like it? My, oh my, it's fresh this morning.
Look at my nipples. Standing up like little soldiers.
She waggles her toes.
What is a girl to do, eh?
Tammy, why don't we meet up now and I'll book a table for lunch.
That's it, what?
Yeah, don't worry about a table. We'll have a bit of room service.
Yeah, okay.
1 hour.
She finishes her nails. At the hotel, he draws the curtains in the room. Tammy sashes along the hotel corridor, a posh carrier bag in her hand. In his room, he mixes himself a drink and sips it. As she nears the door, he stands in front of a full-length mirror and studies his features. He brushes the back of his hand over his mouth and forehead. He looks round at the door, then stretches for his drink. He lifts it to his lips.
Hang on!
He takes a gulp, then opens the door. He studies the sultry blonde in front of him. Her hair is up and she's wearing a smart suit. She moves close to him, forcing him back into the room. He steps back and she shuts the door. She throws down her carrier bag and they keep moving back, the lips now locked in an embrace. She lifts up his t-shirt. He raises his arms to allow her to remove the shirt. He sits, then lies down on the bed. She crawls on top and straddles him. He feels the flesh of her waist.
Oh, shit.
She takes her mobile from her shoulder bag on the bed.
Oh, dude, that signal has driven me fucking mad.
Without answering it, she replaces it in her bag.
We're not expecting Sydney, are we?
He's too busy kissing Duke's ass.
Not around here, I hope.
No. Over by Greenwich Market, so you can relax, everyone. It's just the two of us.
He lifts his head to kiss her. She rides on top of him, pushes himself up to a seated position.
Patience. All good things come to those who wait.
Mm-hmm.
Stay put.
Tammy kisses him, then pushes him back down onto the bed. She climbs off him, picks up the carrier bag and switches into the bathroom. He watches her disappear. He reaches into his jacket for his mobile. As she undresses, he makes a call.
Carl.
She pulls on black stockings.
Hello, it's me. It's me. Look, shut up and listen. Sydney Duke's nephew's working down by Greenwich Market. Go and have a look.
Now a black bra.
Room service.
Yeah, well, look for that yellow Range Rover. Okay.
Tam is also wearing a black suspender belt. He, in his jeans and bare chest, picks up a dressing gown and answers the door.
Champagne, sir.
He's punched in the stomach, bends forward, and gaffer tape is stuck over his mouth. His hands are tied behind his back and a sack thrown over his head. He's bundled into a laundry trolley and wheeled down the corridor. Tammy comes through to an empty room and looks around for him. The sack is pulled off his head. He opens his eyes and panics. He's being held face down over the edge of the roof of a high-rise building.
One moment, Mr. Troop. I want to hear what this callous bastard has to say for himself.
He's lifted to his feet by Troop and his accomplice. He walks, hands still bound behind him, mouth still taped, towards the man who spoke. Against a background of skyscrapers, the man turns.
I'm Jimmy's old colleague, Eddie Temple.
Troop falls off the tape.
Fuck! He told you to locate my daughter, hunt her down like some lost mongrel.
His brow furrows.
He said you asked for his help.
Mr. Troop could find anyone on the planet in 10 minutes flat. If you laid a finger on my little daughter, Charlotte, you'd be over the edge like that. You'd join that other little shit, Kinky. You thought he could take my $5,000 and fuck me over. The audacity. How fucking dare you? I've known Jimmy Price for 45 years. It pays me to keep an eye on him. Do you know what a remora fish is?
Temple paces behind him.
Yes.
Oh, you do? Well, Jimmy's been swimming in my slipstream all my fucking life. I thought he might put some volatile psychopath on the job. But I've checked you out, son. You're a smart boy. But you keep very, very bad company.
Temple walks in front of him.
You know, I host a charity golf tournament every year. It's quite an event on the social calendar, even though I say so myself. I like to invite Jimmy. Some of my friends find him absurdly hilarious.
Drinks are on me! Drinks are everywhere! Champagne! Fucking good gear and all!
But I've come unstuck in my attempts to provide a spectacle for my chums. Jimmy, as usual, on the lookout for tidbits, has made the acquaintance of the development minister of some tin pot republic. They're trawling the West for investments. They have vast deposits of natural resources. Quite an investment for the right man. They've sent in men from Timbuktu, explaining all the details. Profits, shares, long-term investments, short-term investments. They've even made him an honorary citizen. Even made him one of the tribe. What we didn't know, until it all ended in tears, was that the hard-line communist insurgents who control the country outside the mining areas.
Bad news about our little venture, Jim. The communists have broken through the government lines, heading for the capital with little resistance.
What the fuck are you on about?
I saw this, my name. I got word they were planning a major push, the final coup de grace. I told Jimmy. It's all over, Jim.
Fuck's sake.
Keep your voice down, will you?
Get my money out, quick, now.
As if it was some little kiddie's piggy bank.
Now, I explained that wasn't possible. We thought we'd bought a government.
Maybe someone made a better offer. Have a drink. Forget about it. You win some, you lose some.
How much are we talking here, Mr. Temple?
It's only a cheeky half mil, Jim.
It's much more than that.
How much?
13.
13 what?
13 million pounds. I'm fucked.
Have you gone fucking mad? 13 million pounds? God. How could you be so fucking stupid? Now you've been right grafted, royally turned over like some fucking yank buying London Bridge.
Don't you talk to me like that.
You accuse me of instigating it.
I think it's no coincidence I met those fuckers at your tournament.
You fucking demented. Asked me to fly to Zurich to negotiate with the minister, who's still parked up in La Maison Grande. Still eating well. Big fat fucker. On little Jimmy's nest egg.
So Jimmy thought he could keep Charlotte hostage while you went to Zurich to get his money back.
Little Jimmy was so stupid, he thought he couldn't lose either way.
Sorry, what?
Well, if you find Charlotte, he's got his hostage. If I find you trying to find her, I do his dirty work.
I'm still not with you.
Your lives are inextricably linked. You see, I've found out something very interesting about Jimmy. Something I've long suspected.
He stares intently at Temple.
But I'll let Jimmy explain. You follow me.
Temple claps his hands round the narrator's face, then pats his arm before moving away. The band captive is pushed round, and they all walk along the roof of the incomplete high-rise with wire netting round its edges. Temple strides into a workman's lift, followed by his captive and troop. Another accomplice closes the lift's mesh gates, and the lift descends. The lift slowly makes its way down the outside of the tower block. The captive looks more like a prisoner behind bars as he looks out of the lift's mesh side. Captive and captor are seated in the back of a Bentley.
You've no doubt suffered Jimmy's CID was keys as he was at school with routine. The other chap's Albert Carter, another twisted bastard from the old neighbourhood. Member of the regional crime squad. Now you sit back, relax, enjoy.
A CD.
It ain't like doing business for your lot in the old days. They've all gone squeaky on me.
Tell me about it, Jim. I have to box real clever with those wired-up college boys from anti-corruption.
Fucking dogs. Slags.
$10,000.
All right, so go and wait, Jim.
$10,000. Hardly seems worth the bother.
Yeah. There's only so much, you know, sir, for my funds.
In a pub with Carter, Jimmy Price pockets an envelope.
What about Jean? Does he suspect anything?
Well, about me working for the old firm. Listen, Jean
is too loyal for his own good.
He can do a cryptic cross.
Don't fucking believe it.
You better believe it. Because it's fucking happening.
Where did you get this?
Mr. Troop made it for me. It's one of his little hobbies.
I don't fucking believe it.
Don't you want to hear what Jimmy has to say about you?
I've got one for you. Plucked and ready for the pot.
Just give us a name and he's gone.
In time. I don't want a bunce. I want him out of the way.
Flash young run. One of the new breed, isn't he? Reckons he can just walk off into retirement. I want him away for 12.
Well, if he's got a killer class A on board, he's looking at double figures.
I'll put it there myself.
Sounds personal, Jim.
Yeah, he's got a few quid tucked away. He's going to come right in handy.
It's me set him up with that slippery account in the first place. Fucking ragged. Let slip, didn't he?
You'll miss him when he's gone, Mr. Brace.
Is that you? The flash runt who thinks he's retiring? You no idea what Jimmy was up to. How do you think these fuckers earn a living? I would have thought a smart young man like you would know that already.
Can I have that?
Mr. Troop.
Temple leans forward and takes the CD.
Thank you.
He hands it over. Troop makes a left turn.
This looks like you, son. Smart part of town. Anyway, I'll keep an eye open. Mustache off, get home, wash and brush up. Opera tonight. The Damnation of Faust. Man sells his soul to the devil. It all ends in tears. These arrangements usually do.
The Bentley rolls along the mews where the narrator lives. It stops outside his door. He gets out of the car, still wearing the dressing gown, but no longer bound. The window slides down.
One more thing, young man. Always remember, the art of good business is being a good middleman. Bye-bye.
He stands in the road and watches the Bentley drive off. Night, he's in his apartment kitchen. He strides over to a counter and picks up a bottle and a glass. He lays the glass on a table and unscrews the top from the bottle. The top rolls onto the floor. He pours himself a drink. He picks up a phone on the table, steps back from his untouched drink, raises his arm and dashes the phone to the floor.
Fuck!
Drink in hand, he strides through his living room in front of the fireplace, which has flowers in it. On the chimney breast, a bronze-rimmed mirror. He paces back and forth. Eventually, he sits down, and his features grim, his steely blue eyes stare into space. The same steely blue eyes peer out from a black balaclava as the narrator, dressed all in black and carrying Jean's gun, stands leaning against a tree in the middle of the night. He looks to his left, then emerges from behind the tree. He makes his way through undergrowth and the darkened garden. A man descends two steps in a swimming pool and pushes himself off. He swims with a lazy breaststroke, his head and mouth above the water. The narrator keeps moving and the swimmer swimming. The swimmer climbs out of the outdoor pool in the garden of a magnificent mansion. The swimmer, a large man, slips on some shoes and ties a dressing gown round himself. He's being watched from the shrubbery by the narrator. As the swimmer descends a stone staircase, he triggers spotlights which force the narrator to draw back. Jimmy Price, resplendent in white dressing gown, marches down to a lawn. The balaclava figure creeps in the shadows as Jimmy bends down and picks up a hose. He starts to sprinkle the shrubbery. The narrator is behind him, hiding behind bushes. The narrator, his blue eyes sparkling in the light thrown from the garden, edges closer to Jimmy. The gun is firmly in the narrator's hand. Oblivious to him, Jimmy saunters along the lawn, the hose aimed at the plants and bushes in front of him. He stops when the hose snags. The flow of water stops. Jimmy lays down the hose on the grass, then walks back by the side of the hose as the narrator springs out of the bushes behind him, gun raised. Jimmy senses his presence. Jimmy half turns his head, the narrator lowers the gun. Jimmy turns round. The narrator raises the gun inches from Jimmy's forehead. Jimmy slumps to the ground. The narrator turns and runs across the lawn. The hose on the grass sprinkles water from its nozzle. A showerhead sprays water. Under a canal bridge, the gun is removed from a bag and tossed in the water. The narrator stands under the shower. In flashback, wearing a crash helmet, he removes a set of number plates from the rear of a motorbike, revealing the true ones. Takes off a pair of outer socks worn over his shoes and pours petrol on them. He strikes a match and drops it on the clothes on the ground. He looks down at the flames. In the shower, he gazes blankly down. In the flashback, he stares into space. He rides into a garage on the bike. In his apartment, he hauls off the crash helmet. In the bathroom, he opens a medicine cabinet. From a bottle of pills, he lays some on the table. He crushes them with the base of a glass, then scoops them with his hand into the glass. He adds whiskey and drinks it down. He switches on the TV, then remembers Jimmy in the garden. Bare-chested, he leans forward, the muscles on his arms and back rippling. He drinks his whiskey. In bed, he can't sleep. He crushes more pills and drinks his whiskey cocktail. He finishes a bottle. Intermittently, he sits in front of the TV and lies restless in bed. He keeps seeing Jimmy's face. He covers his face with his hand. The empty pill bottle rolls across the table. He goes to the medicine cabinet and rifles through it. Day. He closes the cabinet, reflected in its mirror, him in shirt and tie. He straightens the tie. He opens the cabinet. Save for a packet of banknotes and a passport, it's empty. He removes them. He lays down a briefcase to answer his phone.
Yes?
I've got him.
Got who?
Sydney. Remember? Yellow Range Rover. Seems they sent our little friend out to get something to eat.
Good.
Tell Morty.
He hangs up. In a suit and with a briefcase in his hand, he strides out of the apartment. Clarky and Terry follow the yellow Range Rover with Sydney driving it as it pulls away from the curb. His eyes peeled, the narrator marches along a pavement and up steps to the door of his accountant's building. He makes his way into Mr. Singh's office. He closes the door behind him and sees the place is empty. Marks on the wall indicate where paintings once hung and spots on the carpet where furniture once stood. He leans against a corner and slumps down to the floor. The Range Rover drives by some industrial lockups, brick buildings with tin roofs. It stops by one. Clarky and Terry pull up a short distance from it, outside a wire fence. Terry turns to Clarky.
So what do we do now?
Call Morty.
Greenwich Park, day. The narrator is sitting on a bench overlooking the river. Tower blocks dominate the skyline. He searches in his pocket for his mobile.
Hello.
Shut up and listen. No more insults, no more games. If I do not get my cargo back, you're a dead man.
Dragon, I've been doing some checking. I found out who you represent.
Good.
I think I can point you in the direction of your boss's merchandise.
Come to my hotel room now.
No, look, please. I don't mean to be discourteous, but I think I'd rather meet you in a public place.
You have nothing to fear. I'm a reasonable man.
That's not what I've heard. I'll meet you at...
He's standing in front of a statue of General James Wolfe.
I'll meet you at Greenwich Park Observatory. Any taxi driver will drop you off there.
I can read a map.
Tomorrow, midday.
Tomorrow at 12. I'll be there.
Pigeons on the observation terrace he's standing on take flight. He pockets his phone.
That's rude, Mr. Dragon.
He adjusts his jacket and cuffs, picks up his briefcase and strolls off the terrace. The yellow Range Rover is being scrutinized through binoculars. The narrator joins Terry behind a log. Terry takes his eyes from the binoculars.
The condition's red down there, pal. They're digi as fuck. They haven't moved from that lockup. Have a look at the geyser at the front, on the door.
The narrator takes the binoculars.
I definitely know him from somewhere. This could get a bit messy, you know.
What about the blokes in the red? What do they do?
Well, they're just mechanics. They got their own little ringing crew going, and the lorries come in at night one colour and go out in the morning another. But they're definitely nothing to do with the Duke's boys.
Fuck me, look who it isn't.
Who's that?
Teddy grabs the binoculars.
Doesn't matter. I've got work to do. You stay here. If those pills move, you call me, right?
Yeah, you go.
Day and night, Terry.
What do you mean, night?
Day and night.
I've been here all day. Get Clark, you do it.
Day and fucking night. You got it?
Teddy looks extremely disgruntled as the narrator moves away. The narrator climbs an elegant staircase. He enters a library through a door decorated as if it were a set of bookshelves. He walks into the austere room but sees no one. Eddie Temple's on a balcony.
Hello, young man. Thank you for coming at such short notice. Hope you didn't feel too summoned. How are you?
I'm in the best of health, Mr. Temple. Thank you for asking. How are you keeping?
I'm very well, thank you.
How was the performance of Faust?
Complex. No wonder it took him 60 years to write it.
How's the family?
What the fuck is this? A vicar's tea party?
Well, Mr. Temple, you have been known to take your conversations away with you.
Oh, being a clever bastard, are we? How do I know you're not wired up?
Well, I'm not.
Then we'll have to trust each other, won't we? Sit down.
He's come downstairs. Teddy spots a member of the Duke's gang in an inflatable dinghy on the canal. In the library.
I've been thinking after our little chat the other day. Your pills. How much the lot?
Oh, I've already got a buyer. Nearly took my hand off. Putting the money together now.
I told you, lad, I'm still thinking. It's only been 3 days. What's the fucking hurry?
What's he paying for?
Well, I can't tell you that's confidential.
Don't be an idiot. Let me match his offer.
They've got history. Bad juju. And anyway, the Serbian maniacs in hot pursuit.
See, the thing is, if I sold them to you, I'd have to disappoint him. And he is definitely not the sort of person...
I did you a big fucking favour letting you know about Jimmy. I think you owe me.
2.5 million. In sterling and euros, high denomination use notes.
So if I gave you 3 million, that'd keep everyone happy. Let me state my position. You can sell these pills to whoever you like. That's your privilege. That's your business. But I'll tell you, I'll be very, very unhappy if you don't sell them to me. You understand?
Sitting opposite Temple, the narrator nods and smiles awkwardly.
Okay, Mr. Temple. 3 million done. My buyer's not going to be happy, though.
Fuck him. Here, get over it.
In a covered overpass above a motorway, the narrator steps across to the shaven-headed Trevor and stands beside him. Shanks and Lucky are watching.
I'm going to need some help. Someone who can eliminate the problem. Someone who's a bit handy, yeah?
Oh, whoa. Slow down, kidder.
The two men stand face to face.
Mr. Luckett is a drop of freelance work. I don't need to know. None of my business. You tell him when, and he'll come down on the train.
The narrator nods.
Thanks, Trev. Excuse me.
Trevor heads off to join Shanks and Lucky as the narrator answers his phone.
Mr. Temple.
You deliver them to my bonded warehouse. When do I get my consignment?
Tuesday, probably.
Tuesday? I'm paying over the odds, remember? England, typical. Even drug dealers don't work weekends.
Night. Teddy is rooted to the spot behind the log, binoculars to his eyes. He lowers the glasses and takes a cigarette from his mouth. He unscrews the top of a bottle. The narrator's in a car with Morty.
That's good news. That should cheer Gene up.
Yeah. Everything's under control.
They stop in Gene's heavy plant yard.
By the way, Cody's been calling chasing this 10 grand. You gotta pay him.
Yeah, I'll call him later.
A somber Gene greets them at the door.
Hey, you know what's up?
He locks Morty out.
What's the good news, Gene?
Oh, yeah? What's that?
You murdered and bastard!
Gene, open the fucking door, man!
Stay out of this, Morty!
Gene!
You murdered and bastard!
Murder? Who's dead?
Jimmy! Jimmy's dead?
He killed him! Louis fucking...
Get away! Fucking dog, you hear me?
Why? Gene whacks the narrator's head inside a freezer.
Fucking dog!
He repeatedly thumps the head against the frozen food. Morty crashes in.
What the fuck? Get off him! No, Nick! Listen, Morty.
Morty hauls Gene away.
Listen to me, Morty! I got a call earlier from a cousin we've got bent. They found Jimmy's body last night. In his own backyard. It was this sly bastard.
This boy's no killer, man. Somebody's made a fucking mistake.
All right, come on.
Okay. He opens a piece of paper.
Read it out loud.
The senior ranks only murder squad investigation, victim James Lionel Price.
Now, the ballistics report. Read the fucking ballistics report.
Preliminary ballistic report. No rounds recovered, disintegrated on impact. One recovered cartridge casing.
Yeah, you forgot to take the cartridge case, didn't you? You got sloppy.
Jack pattern consistent with murder weapon used in unsolved homicide of Lawrence Francis Gower, also known as Crazy Larry Flynn.
Wait a minute. I got it. Whoever killed Crazy Larry must have killed Jimmy.
No. The fucking gun was the same. The one he stole from my flat.
You killed Crazy Larry. This fucker killed Jimmy.
Oh, Jesus Christ!
Gene kicks the narrator in the ribs. His face is covered in blood. Morty grabs him by the collar.
Why did he do it?
He was an infather! He was a blatant father!
Jimmy, you grass! Are you fucking mad? You'll have to do better than that.
I've got a recording at home of Jimmy and a cousin called Albie Carter!
Gene. Let's listen to this shit. If he's lying, we'll both fucking kill him.
Mr. Mortimer reckons the Tylers are bringing in shooters from Jamaica via Manchester. They got someone in immigration straight now.
Oh, I don't think anybody gives a fuck about spades shooting spades.
Don't you care about dead darkies, Albert?
What about Gene? Did he suspect anything?
What? About me working for the odd firm.
The narrator stops the CD.
Convinced?
Gene and Morty are sitting in the narrator's apartment.
You don't fuck about, you?
The narrator pours a whiskey. Each of them has a glass.
Jimmy was skint, huh? That's why he set up the whole Amsterdam business with Duke.
Mm.
They're sitting side by side at a breakfast counter in the apartment.
I really think that we should keep all of this to ourselves, right?
Really?
The narrator's in the middle. Morty turns to Gene.
Why did you kill Larry? Funny enough, it was Jimmy persuaded me. Jimmy never liked Larry from the start.
Look at that wrong and waving his money around. It ain't right.
A flashback.
Hey! I love you, man.
He saw the future was drugs. Needed to be run like a business. Crazy Larry was no fucking businessman. After that business with Kilburn and Jerry.
That's it, son. You do him. Bollocks!
He wanted him gone, and I didn't have any problem doing him.
Gene places a pillow over Larry's head and shoots him. The narrator and Morty stare.
That's why I did it.
But why did you keep the gun?
It sounds silly now, but it was me favorite.
Well, I hope you don't tell the other guns you got favorites.
Arms on the counter, the three of them look wistful. Gene leans into the narrator.
So what's the next move, boss?
All eyes are on the narrator. He looks at Gene.
Well, I'm going to bed. Don't know what you two are doing. We can talk about it tomorrow.
Day, a busy railway station. Passengers disembark from a train. The narrator walks along a platform and sees Lucky in the distance, headphones on, fiddling with his luggage. Lucky straightens up and hauls his trolley suitcase behind him. The narrator stands waiting. His face is bruised on the left cheek and around the eye. Lucky walks straight past him. The narrator about turns and follows him. In a taxi...
Bonjour. Ça va?
Sorry.
Madame's... Shoes may unfold.
Sorry, mate, what was that?
Lucky peels off a headphone.
Did you pack that in, pal?
Got a fucking test next week.
Okay, I'm sorry, I was just saying.
Je m'appelle Jean Paul. Je suis anglaise.
The two of them are standing at the rail of the observation terrace in front of the statue of General Wolfe, the high-rise buildings in the distance across the river.
So when does the target get here, then?
The target? The target's going to be here at exactly midday.
Where?
Here, right fucking here.
You got a photo?
No, it's okay. Don't worry about it.
He's worried?
I'm going to have some binoculars. I'll give you a little signal, won't we?
I could get the 1:10 home from here. Let's have a little recce.
They walk down a hill.
After we do the business, walk slowly back. Remember, it's a stroll in the park. Don't run, whatever you do. For the first 5 minutes, nobody's going to have a clue what's going on. Hopefully it'll be mayhem.
The narrator puts binoculars to his eyes. Lucky takes them from him.
So try to stay relaxed. Don't do anything to draw attention to yourself. Or me. Afterwards, take me to the underground station. I'll look after myself.
He spots a few people, then a clump of trees.
There.
He fixes a telescopic lens to a rifle.
Time.
The narrator on the ground beside him checks his watch.
6:12.
Lucky cocks the rifle.
I hope this fella's not going to be late.
Through the sights, a grey-haired man with a dog.
Maybe he'll be early.
That'd be nice.
A woman pushes a pram in front of the statue. Through the binoculars, the narrator spots a guy in a baseball cap walking up the hill.
Can you see that guy on the left?
Lucky swivels the rifle round and gets the guy in the crosshairs of the sights.
Big fella marching up the hill.
That's our man.
Lucky follows him through the sights.
Are you sure?
For fuck's sake, I'm gonna call him.
It's up to you. You're the client.
The narrator dials. The guy stops on the observation terrace.
As soon as he answers, he's gone, okay?
Okie dokie.
Lucky's finger hovers over the trigger.
Stand by.
The guy reaches in his jacket pocket.
Now.
Blood spatters the knees.
Hello. May I help you?
Lucky's been shot through the head.
Don't move a muscle.
The narrator stares straight ahead.
Do I have your attention?
Yes.
You English, you have no idea of honor and respect. I usually kill for less.
The guy's disappeared.
I want my cargo and the Duke.
I haven't got your pills. Just give me a day.
A bullet hits the ground.
Don't piss in my pocket and tell me it's raining. Now listen to me for the last time. You bring me what is mine.
No, I don't.
Jesus!
You have one more day.
The narrator is still on his stomach on the ground.
See you tomorrow at dusk by the statue. And remember, I will be watching you.
The narrator stares at his mobile, then glances briefly at Lucky's case lying beside him. His brow is furrowed. Later, he's with Morty and Jean.
What the fuck were you thinking about? Getting Trevor's man down here to shoot this Serb in a public park?
Trevor's gonna go ballistic. Now what the fuck do I tell him?
Look at the fucking mess you've made.
You've gone fucking mad, haven't you?
You think you're a gangster, huh?
Fuck off.
You wanna play? Well, you do it somewhere else, because if you do it near me, I'll put you in a fucking wheelchair. Stick to your fucking sums!
Listen. Listen to me. Dragon's already killed Paul. He's done the Duke. He's just put a bullet right between Lucky's eyes. I was fucking there. He's watching our every move. I mean, who's next? Me?
I wish.
Oh, fuck off. Look, it could have been you or Morty.
Morty waves a hand dismissively and rises to his feet.
Dragon said he wanted the pills and the Duke. Where the fuck's the Duke?
Morty walks over beside Jean and pours himself a drink. They both turn.
What?
Morty and Jean exchange a look, then Jean faces the narrator.
I should have told you this earlier.
He walks into the kitchen.
Duke and Slasher came by the office the other day.
What?
Look, Paul the Boatman was top last night, right? I mean, I've got to get on my toes sharpish here, mate.
Oi! I want Jimmy brought here right now, yeah? Getting that smug fucking yuppie bastard to tell Duke that those pills are useless after sending us over there in the fucking first place,
hang
yeah?
On, hang on, you've lost me now.
Yeah, well, if you have us over, I swear by fucking almighty God, I'll call the fucking law.
Wait, wait, Sasha, what
I
are you talking about?
I swear fucking
shut your fucking noise, you didn't mean that.
I do Jeez, fucking mean it. I fucking do call the fucking law, I will.
You didn't mean
I'll call the fucking law.
Jean's heavy shoots him in the forehead. The Duke slowly turns round and the bald-headed bodyguard shoots him. The heavy turns to Jean, who pulls a face. Jean opens his freezer.
Oh.
That's where I plan on being a gangster gets you. You're not in there because I like you.
The three of them stare into the open chest freezer.
I'm beginning to feel left out.
Why? I seem to remember Freddie Hurst is still in intensive care after your jolly little reunion the other day.
Fucking hell, Duke. For once, you might be of some use.
The narrator closes the freezer lid. Night, he's in Jean's yard. In the background, high-rise buildings and the River Thames. He walks towards his car, carrying a blue and white insulated icebox. He places it in the open hatchback.
That was Gaz on the phone. It's on. We'll pick you up at 9 o'clock in the morning, Gallup's Corner, you know?
Yeah.
Hey. With Jimmy gone, these pills are going to make a nice fat contribution to my retirement fund. So don't fuck things up again, okay? If you do, you'll wish this dragon had shot you between the eyes, understand?
The steely blue eyes turn away from Jean.
Best of luck.
He turns to look at Jean.
Thanks.
The river at night. The reflection of the illuminated high-rise city buildings ripples on the surface of the water. A light flashes intermittently on the roof of the tallest one. The narrator's in his apartment on the phone. In Pammy's flat, Sydney answers her mobile. She's not in the room.
Hello? Hello? Fuck off!
Sydney, I have told you, stop answering my phone, okay? Who was it?
Wrong number, Tim.
The narrator, sitting on his bed, lays down his phone, then leans back and rests his head on the covers, his eyes wide open. Morning, the skyline of London. A boat cruises up the Thames. The narrator stands by a busy road, arms folded, dark specs on. He's in jeans, open-neck shirt, and jacket. Sydney drives up in the yellow Range Rover and stops beside him. He opens the door and climbs in next to Sydney.
Right, mate.
Hello, Sydney.
How you doing, Ian?
I'm all right, thank you, Sydney. How are you?
I'm all right, mate. Yeah.
They pull up at the industrial lockups. An advertising board spins in the wind. They get out of the Range Rover. The ever-eager Sydney, in a tracksuit, leads him up to a cropped-haired heavy. The narrator is frisked, then follows the heavy up a stone stairway with a blue metal handrail. Sydney brings up the rear. They're being watched through binoculars. Inside.
Gather, this place stinks. We want to get you out of here. A 50 pence a pill. At least that way, we all come out with something in our pocket.
Yeah, I think they're worth a lot more than that.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Gazza, this is a reality check! And Paul's dead, Jimmy's dead, Duke and Slasher, fuck knows where they are! This gear is knockoff, and the Serbs you nicked it from, well, they kill you like you'd take a piss!
A van bursts through the gates. Armed police jump from the van.
Come on, let's have it!
Don't point that fucking gun at me!
Put it down!
Go with it!
Gazza, look at me! Look at me! Put the gun down! You're gonna get us all shot! Fuck!
Gazza throws down the gun and runs. The police ram the door and burst in as the gangs get at it, the narrator with them. He comes to a closed metal shutter, then sees a door. Sydney are together. Gazza and his group are separated from Sydney. The police chase both groups. Sydney and the narrator come to a doorway. The narrator runs past it. He checks back and runs through. He hauls over a cabinet. A policeman falls over it. The man holding the binoculars sees police officers carry cardboard boxes onto the van. Sydney and the narrator are outside.
Gazza! Wait!
Fucking hurry up!
Get in!
He jumps into a dinghy. Sydney jumps but falls into water. The narrator reaches for him. He's still in the water as the dinghy roars off. The narrator has hold of him and drags Sydney on board. The police at the canal side watch the departing dinghy. Sydney, holding his head, stares at his rescuer. Night. In a dark Greenwich park, the narrator sits on a bench in front of the statue on the observation terrace. Beside him, the blue and white insulated icebox. His arm twitches as it leans on the box. He turns to his right and then back round. Across the water, the light on the roof of the building flashes on and off.
Is this for me?
He spins round to see a man sitting on the other side of the box.
Yes.
Dragon opens the box, looks inside, then closes the lid. Both men stare across the water.
Your cargo's gone, I'm afraid. It was seized by...
I know already.
How do you know?
I watched.
I don't believe this! Cactus gonna go fucking spare! We are in shit! You lot are fucked up again! Oh, fucking hell.
A flashback to the morgue.
Right, leave it to me, lads. I'll explain to Inspector Cox that his suspect, a scarper, because you're blundering. Fucking knobheads. Helmets off!
Delta uniform, Kilo Echo.
Dragon watches as detectives join the armed officers. In the park, the narrator lowers his head and doesn't look at Dragon.
Does this settle things, then?
Both men stare across the water. Dragon lifts the handle of the icebox, then stands up. He walks away, taking the icebox with him. The narrator's shoulders sag and he sighs with relief. Day, in an underground car park, the narrator gets out of his car. A flashback to the police and the lockups. The narrator stops by Jean's car.
How did that other little errand go?
Success. As far as I could make out.
The detective at the lockups is Cody.
Where is my fucking prisoner? You old ladies couldn't catch a fucking cold if you tried!
No, I just want to say...
Shut up, you soppy wanker!
Tiptoes.
Go. Bingo bongo.
Teddy and Clarky.
So tell me, is this area now secure?
Yes, sir.
Well, you can fuck off then, can't you?
So where are the pills, genius?
I visit them now.
He walks out to meet the Yellow Range Rover as it turns into the car park. Cody and Tiptoes in the front seat.
Couldn't leave this behind.
Greenies.
Clarky hands Cody a sports bag.
You are in the wrong game, mate. You should work with us.
Are we square?
Tiptoes checks the bag.
Yeah, we're sweet.
Same, sir. So your pills are in the back. Help yourself.
With a smile, he goes to the back of the Range Rover. Night. St. Paul's Cathedral is lit up. Morty's car crosses a bridge over the Thames. Teddy and Clarky are in the back. Morty's driving and the narrator is on his mobile.
Hello?
He listens intently.
Okay. Yes, it will do. Bye-bye.
He places the phone in his inside breast pocket.
You're off the hook, Morty. Freddy Hurst is out of his coma.
There's no reaction from Morty. Teddy taps Morty's arm.
Good news. Hey. Good news, mate. Listen, got one for you. Irishman, Courtney sounds snorty Charlie. He said if I catch you doing that again, I'll rub your fucking nose in it.
Morty's Audi is being followed by Jean and his heavy. The two vehicles drive into Eddie Temple's bonded warehouse, which seems half empty. The two cars stop side by side by crates marked with Temple's name, and all six men clamber out. Temple sits in the shadows of the office and watches as the narrator walks up to Troop.
Do you have the pills?
In the cars.
Boss wants to see you in his office.
Troop about turns. The narrator indicates to his associates to stay put and follows Troop across the warehouse to the office.
Ah, come in. Sit down.
Troop shuts the door, leaving the two men alone.
Yeah? Payment.
The narrator picks up the envelope tossed on the desk by Temple. He unfolds a document and reads it.
You look shocked, son.
You taking the fucking piss?
You and Jimmy have caused my little angel Charlotte considerable anxiety. She's off to Arizona for a course of intense treatment. I'm keeping those pills for myself by way of compensation. I think I'm entitled. Simple. End of. The amount of trouble you've caused the last few days, Jimmy. Poor little Jimmy. I think it would be in your interest if this thing finishes here now, today. Understand?
Well, it doesn't matter what I do. This lot are going to come after you.
Now, they're too long in the tooth to go
rampaging around the country, looking for revenge. Look at them. Bunch of underendowed, aging...
Fuck pigs.
Are you enjoying this?
No, on the contrary. Take it as a compliment. You're a bright young man. This monkey business is in your blood, under your skin. You're not getting out, you're just getting in. You're only getting started. I've every faith in you. And one day in the future, it'll be you sitting here in my place, telling some young Turk the facts of life.
And they are, Mr. Temple.
Temple rises from the desk and the tannoy microphone and strides over to the window. He looks out to where Jean and the others are held at gunpoint.
You're born, you take shit. Get out in the world, you take more shit. Climb a little higher, take less shit. Till one day you're up in the rarefied atmosphere and you've forgotten what shit even looks like.
Temple turns to face the younger man.
Welcome to the layer cake, son.
His face still battered and bruised, he lowers his head. Temple goes to the door and indicates for him to follow. Temple marches out. He follows him and flings his arms out in despair. Temple goes to his Bentley.
This thing ends here tonight, you understand? Drug money's easy money, not grief. The odds, as you can see, are against you. Good night.
He climbs into the back seat and is driven off. Troop and his armed colleagues get into a Land Rover with the pills and set off after him, leaving the others standing in the warehouse. The six men slowly return to their two cars. The city streets of London.
If you're going to hang around in this game, that's where you've got to aim to be. Sitting in your bonded warehouse with the ex-professional soldiers doing the dirty work, while you deliver the highly suspect educational lecture to battle your opponents and cover your tracks.
Dragon with the icebox.
The art of good business is being a good middleman, putting people together. I'll always thank Eddie for telling me that.
Slavo squats by the box.
It's all about honor and respect.
Inside is the Duke's head.
This is the end, Mr. Duke. As I told you. Pirule?
Polizia.
Slavo taps Dragon's shoulder, then places an arm round him and they stride off. The door behind them, on which is painted a flower with five petals, slides open to reveal a man carrying a cardboard box out of a drug laboratory, which is a conveyor belt, and women packaging pills. A cardboard box with the flower design is carried from the back of the Land Rover. Slumped over the steering wheel, his head covered in blood, is Troop. The box is carried to the back of a van in which Trevor and Shanks are sitting.
Day one. I fucking enjoyed that, brother.
Just like the old days, Shanks. Nice bit of armed robbery.
Hello.
You all right?
Where do you want the money sent, now?
As soon as I do, Trev.
And again, look, I am sorry about Lucky.
Don't worry about it, kiddo. Mum was a prick anyway. Later.
Ready?
Yes, good.
Did I really think Eddie was going to give me 3 million for those pills? Did I fuck? But suddenly, there was a void where once there was Jimmy Price. And after a couple of days of going around in my head, Eddie's little getting in and getting out speech started to make sense.
The document from Temple was life membership of the Stoke Park Club, with a letterhead, a print of the club itself. The palatial club with a fountain in its courtyard has a colonnaded facade. The narrator stands leaning against one of the columns. In white trousers and pale blue shirt, he moves inside past a curtain billowing in the wind. In the dining room, he meets the maître d'.
Angelo, thank you.
Thank you very much. Can we get some privacy?
Of course.
In the room he dined with Jimmy sit Morty, Jean, Terry and Clarkie drinking brandy and smoking cigars. Clarkie gets to his feet.
King is dead. Long live the king.
They all sip their brandies. Clarkie sits down.
Well, I'm honoured.
The narrator picks up his white jacket.
But for me, this is all over. I'm getting out. What was true then is true now. Have a plan, stick to it. So I'm sure you gentlemen must have lots to discuss, but I have no business being here.
They all stare at the narrator.
Got someone to meet.
Morty blows out a plume of smoke.
Adios, amigo.
Morty raises his fingers from his cigar in a sort of wave as the narrator opens the double doors, marches out of the private dining room and past Angelo.
Paul the boatman. Kinky. The Duke. Slasher. Kilburn Jerry. Crazy Larry. Mr. Lucky. Troop.
Waiting outside for him is Tammy.
Jimmy. I don't want to add my name to that list.
The narrator turns to camera.
My name? If you knew that, you'd be as clever as me.
No! Sydney, waving a gun in front of him, bustles over. The narrator is lying on the steps.
I'm sorry.
Sydney drops the gun and runs off. Tammy kneels beside the wounded narrator. There's blood on the steps and on the white jacket on the right side of the chest. The narrator writhes in pain and struggles for breath. He looks up at Tammy and tries to smile. She rubs his uninjured left shoulder tenderly. The wind ruffles his short, fair hair. ITFC audio description by James O'Hara and John Walskill was voiced by James O'Hara. Cast in order of appearance, the narrator, Daniel Craig. Clarkie, Tom Hardy. Duke, Jimmy Foreman. Slasher, Sally Hawkins. Gazza, Vern Gorman. Nobby, Brindley Green. Morty, George Harris. Terry, Tamar Hassan. Gene, Colm Meaney. Slavo, Marcel Duras. Paul the Boatman, Francis McGee. Angelo, Dimitri Andreas. Jimmy Price, Kenneth Cranham. Brian, Gary Tubbs. Charlie, Natalie Lungi. Kinky, Marvin Benoit. Mickey, Rab Affleck. Cody, Dexter Fletcher. Tiptoes, Steve John Shepherd. Sydney, Ben Wishaw. Tammy, Sienna Miller. Lucky, Paul Orchard. Shanks, Stephen Walters. Trevor, Lewis Emmerich. Junkie 1, Darren Healy. Junkie 2, Matt Ryan. Freddie Hurst, Ivan Kay. Larry, Crazy, Jason Fleming. Jerry, Kilburn, Ben Brazier. Troop, Neil Finnegan. Eddie Temple, Michael Gambon. Golf host, Budgie Pruitt. Albert Carter, Don McCorkindale. Dragon Mikanovich. Soundtrack on EMI Records Limited. Hailing, written by Daniel Ormondroyd, John Lowell, Hafliz Hold, and John Collier. Performed by FC Kahuna. She Sells Sanctuary, performed by The Cult. Tits on the Radio, written by Scott Hoffman, Jason Sellards, and Anna Lynch, performed by Scissor Sisters. Can't Get Blue Monday Out of My Head, written by Peter Hook, Bernard Sumner, Stephen Morris, Julian Gilbert, Kathy Dennis, and Rob Davis, performed by Kylie Minogue. You Got the Love, written by John Bellamy, Anthony Harris, and Anthony Stevens, performed by The Source, featuring Candy Staton. Making Plans for Nigel, written by John Bellamy, Anthony Harris, and Anthony Stevens, performed by XTC. Ordinary World, written by Simon LeBon, John Taylor, Warren Cucurullo, and Nick Rhodes, performed by Duran Duran. Gimme Shelter, written by Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, performed by The Rolling Stones. Ruthless Gravity, written and performed by Craig Armstrong. Fall to the Floor, Soul Savers Mix, written by James Walsh, James Telfox, Barry Westhead, and Benjamin Byrne, performed by Star Sailor. Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood, written by Benny Benjamin, Gloria Caldwell, and Saul Marcus, performed by Joe Cocker. Producers would like to thank Barlow World, Bow Concept, Karina Hag Design, Defy Interiors, JCB, Kilgar Savile Row London, Nick Laird Close. The logo is for the Motion Picture Association of America, number 40603. Kodak Motion Picture Film. SDDS. Sony Dynamic Digital Sound in selected theaters. Dolby Digital in selected theaters. The characters and incidents portrayed and the names herein are fictitious, and any similarity to the name, character, or history of any person is entirely coincidental and unintentional. This motion picture photoplay is protected pursuant to the provisions of the laws of the United States of America and other countries. Any unauthorized duplication and or distribution of this photoplay may result in civil liability and criminal prosecution. Released by Columbia Pictures, a Sony Pictures Entertainment Company.